Welcome to Artist on Air, the podcast for SaaS founders and operators looking to scale smarter and build stronger brands. Today, we are thrilled to be joined by Angele Mullins, a seasoned SaaS leader with over 20 years of experience shaping iconic brands like GoDaddy, Intuit, or Amazon. Angele shares why branding isn't just for later stages, it's a game changer from day one onwards. Tune in for very actionable insights on crafting belief-driven brands, leverage and storytelling, standing out in competitive markets, and many, many more insights into how to build a super successful B2B SaaS brand. Let's dive in, enjoy, and yeah, let's go.
Artist on Air, the SaaS podcast for the German-speaking market. Valuable tips from successful entrepreneurs, top investors, and leading industry partners to help you scale your business quickly. Compiled by Jan Spandorski, Julius Göllner, and Matthias Ernst.
Good afternoon, Angele.
Good afternoon. Really nice to be here.
Smiling face in front of the camera. Very nice that you came to the Artist Podcast Recording Studio. How are you today?
I'm really good, although it's very cold outside, but really good. And, you know, this studio is amazing. What space, what view. Really, really nice to be here.
Really nice to have you. We will talk about SaaS branding today, but before we start, it would be super cool to know about your brand. So what are you doing, Angele? And what's your background?
So for all the listeners, I'm Angele Mullins. My most recent role has been the Chief Commercial Officer at Resourcify, which is a B2B sustainability startup. I'm going to be moving on from there, starting new things. So watch out for 2025. I have a 20-year history, though, all in marketing, digital revenue growth, and of course, branding, my favorite topic. And I've done 3 scaling motions, big tech companies like Amazon, Intuit, GoDaddy, and then also 3 scale-ups, and have a lot of experience across many different markets. So really exciting for our conversation today.
Really exciting on my side, Angele. I'd like to, of course, participate in your learnings and experience. And I think our listeners would like to do as well. So maybe we directly jump into it. You know, like branding in SaaS, especially early stage, is something which is probably not the most prominent thing which comes to founders' minds. So maybe first question from my side, is this a mistake, or what kind of mistakes do you see in an early stage motion?
It's a really great question, and I personally think it's a huge mistake. I am completely on this mission to educate founders and operators to please start your branding very early in your SaaS scaling motions. It's something that e-commerce and D2C has mastered that I think B2B is still picking up on. You know, I recently gave a talk where I talked about this chart of death. And usually what happens is you start in your, I would say, scaling customer acquisition motions. You put a lot of money into performance marketing. And since we're in Berlin, I will say Berlin is a very performance marketing heavy because of Rocket Internet. And usually what happens is companies and founders don't understand their ICP yet. They're still trying to find the product market fit. So they say, hey, let's just throw a bunch of money, push a bunch of ads, and then you get the roller coaster. You go up, you get all your leads, and then you figure out, hey, this doesn't match our ICP, or we really need to start tweaking our ICP. Then founders and early stage operators say, halt everything. So they stop all the budgets, they kill everything. And then you see that graph, that roller coaster ride go down. And usually this happens for anywhere 2 to 4 cycles, usually within, you know, definitely your pre-seed, seed, and Series A. Until then, B2B SaaS founders and leaders say, hey, what about our brand? What do we actually stand for? And especially if they're also, you know, pairing that with outbound sales motions and their SDRs are doing, you know, the calls or the sequences, companies are like, who are you again? And you find that you have this educational motion. So now this has happened over the past, I want to say, 2 to 4 years. So now B2B SaaS leaders and operators are really starting to pay much more close attention to brand and starting their branding motions at much earlier stages.
What does that exactly mean, Angele? Like much earlier stages? When is a good time to really start thinking about your own brand?
At the beginning. And this is really what I tell founders and, you know, early stage operators is at the beginning, start with the what do you believe statement. I know it might sound very conventional, but I'm a fan of Tony Robbins. So for any of the listeners out there that know Tony Robbins and his videos, he talks about sales and he says, people don't buy what you sell, they believe what you believe. And the problem that we do that I say e-commerce does well that B2B SaaS is catching up on is a lot of B2B SaaS companies don't talk about what they believe. they talk about their product and they talk about product marketing, and product marketing is great. But we've all seen what I call the chintzy product marketing videos. Here's my product, you know, here's the problem, we're going to solve the world, you know, and you know exactly what I'm talking about. But nobody actually really exemplifies what you believe. And consumers nowadays, B2B consumers as well, they're really voting with their value. So it's not just about price offering and even value selling, although that's still very important, but it's really about their value system. And this is where this branding can really help. So at the beginning, as soon as you can.
So let's assume I'm a founder, Anjali, and I'm in this very early stage experimenting to try to find my ICPs, to sharpen my value proposition. So I have a lot of problems on my table already. And I, to be very honest, really don't know where is the perceived value for my clients. Yeah, I have some assumptions, but as you said, like, you know, it's a little bit like shooting in the dark. So isn't it like too early and a waste of time and resources to think about a brand so early if I'm not sure about who are my core customers and other things?
You know, the really interesting thing, because I've heard that from founders, I've heard it from early stage go-to-market operators. And the really interesting thing about this is when you go through your branding exercise, it's very similar to your go-to-market motion. You have to talk about the product. You have to talk about what you believe. You have to talk about who's going to resonate with it, your tone of voice, who your ICP is. Is, you know, is that tone different in different markets? Or maybe if you're going towards different departments and, you know, you're doing a, you know, enterprise sales play, for example. So all of this fits together. And the interesting thing is that a lot of early stage founders and go-to-market operators, they go straight towards price. They go straight towards product features. And we've all seen, you know, on websites, we've all seen with SaaS offerings, what I call the chart of death, which is here is our offering and here's a chart of how it compares against our competitors' offerings. And they do the check boxes of which features we have and which features the competitors have. And supposedly that's supposed to give us so much value and we're supposed to understand. And no, it doesn't. And all I usually say is it's a race to the bottom. Because some company can always outfeature you. Another company or competitor can always, you know, put a price lower, and it's a race to the bottom. But when you look at the biggest brands that we all know and love, Apple, Nike, you know, and I know a lot of these are either e-commerce or D2C, but again, they've mastered this art of branding. You know, the classic example that I give is you take an Apple MacBook or a MacBook Air, and you take a Microsoft Surface tablet. And you've seen the comparisons. The actual Microsoft Surface tablet has completely, you know, overcompensated, outcompeted by all the specs and features over the Apple product. But people continue to buy Apple. Why is that? Because of their brand.
Interesting. And very interesting that you say founders become a bit more aware about branding over the last 2-3 years, especially in the DACH ecosystem here. So I'd like to ask the counter question, why for such a long time people have not been taken care of branding very early? I think you said, like, okay, we are probably performance-driven ecosystem here, but I guess this is not the only reason.
Yeah, it's not the only reason, but what I can say is an American, you know, moving now to Germany and have been in this ecosystem for the past 4 years, I've seen that, you know, we've taken this data-driven marketing approach to the ultimate extreme. Do we want to be data-driven? Absolutely. Do we want to have an ROI equation? Absolutely. We want to make sure that marketing is contributing to the revenue line. However, that's not the only thing that marketing does. And I think especially in the DACH ecosystem, a lot of founders and go-to-market leaders have just focused on this one tiny little area of marketing. And this is where you see a lot of overcompensation for performance marketing. And they say, we put €1 in, how many are we getting out? There's other types of marketing out there called brand marketing and content marketing and awareness. And what happens is, because we want these fast returns, and because a lot of times early stage founders and operators are focused on, we have to prove that the product can sell, right? And I understand it's a legitimate, you know, concern and goal, but because they're really just so focused on that, they want to know that return very fast instead of thinking of the long-term gains. So I call brand the original revenue driver, and it's the long-term revenue driver. So even if you're investing in stocks, crypto, whatever you're doing it for the long term. And the same for your business. This is the investment that will keep on giving over time so that you can have a graph that goes up and to the right and you don't have a graph that looks like a roller coaster.
You mentioned Nike, Anjali, you mentioned Apple. So these are indeed great brands, and there are also a couple of great brands in B2B SaaS. The question I'm having now is like, what makes a great brand a great brand? So which kind of components do I as a founder need to think of to build a great, successful, appealing brand?
So, I mean, first I'll answer kind of the first part of your question on, you know, a B2B SaaS company that does branding well, which I'm absolutely in love with Snowflake. I really like the branding that they do. It's absolutely incredible. And when you take a look at them, they're an example of a very, they have a product and a service that's very technical, but they've really made it come to life. And they've done what I would call their consumer, even though they're B2C, you know, their end users, they've done branding that way. And they've also done a really great job at employer branding as well. So when you kind of look at the comprehensive kind of branding ecosystem. But then to answer the other part of your question, just because, you know, for all the listeners, you know, a lot of people know and love Nike, and I think it's a great example. You know, the example I always give in the metaphor is whether you wear Nike or Adidas or whichever, they don't do their marketing and their branding on the rubber, the material that they make out of a shoe. They don't say, you know, the Nike 10X whatever shoe, and here's the rubber and the laces are made of this and all of that. They're not doing that. That would be the equivalent in the B2B SaaS world of going full force on the product marketing. There is a place for it and it is important, but do you go full force on that at the beginning? No, you create this feeling. So what Nike does, and they had this campaign, amazing, it was called Find Your Greatness. And so when you look, and so everyone, I challenge you, go onto YouTube, type this in, and they had just, whether it's men or women, overcoming their challenges. They had one guy who was, you know, trying to run down the street, and they were going through all the, you know, thoughts in his head and how he's trying to, you know, overcome these challenges. And as a consumer, you're like, yeah. And, you know, you're rooting for this guy and you're like, yeah, I can totally identify with him. And that's the hook right there. That's the hook. And that's what your consumers, even in the B2B space, will remember. The other example I give is every B2B consumer is also an e-commerce consumer. And they say, oh, well, no, it's totally different. And I say, okay, no, it's not. Here we go. Take out your mobile phones, everybody. Look at all the apps on your phone. You are a B2B operator. You still have all those apps. You have Amazon, you have Netflix, you have whichever you have. You think the same. The thinking is the same. You're aligning with companies for a particular reason. And as a B2B consumer, you're still looking at this. Yes, you're looking at product marketing. You're looking at price. Does it, you know, match what I need? But if you are going toe-to-toe, if you are a B2B founder or operator, and you are going toe-to-toe with a competitor, your end consumer is going to choose you not only because of your product price features, but also because of that brand feeling. And especially if you're competing against one, two, three other companies, you've sent out RFPs, whatever your process may be, it's going to help you in the long run. And ask your SDR teams when they are creating those sequences, when they're doing those calls and people say, yeah, oh, I know who you are. I saw that campaign, or I saw that piece of content, or, oh my gosh, I totally identified. Trust and believe that it will make a difference in the long run.
As you heard, brand can be a significant driver for growth, and for growth, you need capital. Short shout out here to our ecosystem partner, Float. Sometimes you come across a connection that just clicks, and that's exactly what happened when we met Yannis and Cedric back in 2022 at a kitesurfing event. Since then, Float has been an incredible partner for the whole artist team, supporting us from the beginning. Float is a game changer for funding SaaS businesses, no matter the occasion, whether you're looking to extend your runway or invest in growth. They've got flexible funding options for all your needs. What I appreciate most about Float is how straightforward they are. Onboarding is simple. You get access to a credit line you can use as needed. You only pay for what you actually use, so there's no extra cost hanging over you. Plus, they make the funding experience personal. You're talking to real people, not just dealing with automated systems. If you're looking for a funding partner that truly understands your needs, talk to Float. Meet Yannis, Cedric, and the crew at one of our events, or contact Yannis directly at Yannis with double N at gofloat.io. Also, be sure to visit gofloat.io and try out their calculator to play around with your options. Back to the pod. I wanted to talk about this a bit later, but I think it's a very good point, the measurability of brand. Yeah, because you said, okay, ask your SDRs and okay, let's imagine or let's think about we are building a brand and now we are competing maybe for a budget which traditionally have been at performance. So yeah, well, there is probably a trade-off. So how in your companies, Anjali, did you set up the measurement of the success of building a brand? How do you try to get an ROI around it? Because I think this is one of the biggest challenges many companies face in this term. So some recommendations, please. How would you evaluate success?
So one of the things I tell specifically to marketing leaders, and what happens usually in B2B SaaS is you have marketing competing against sales, which should absolutely never happen because these are the two departments. I mean, we have customer success as well, but these are the two main departments within your commercial arena that need to be in lockstep with each other. And the reason I say this is because a lot of times marketing will say we're delivering the leads and sales will say, you know, no, you're not. So we try to get out of this situation. I'll give an example when I was at GoDaddy. We were just creating, this was 2017 at the time, and we were just creating our first website building product. So our first B2B SaaS, we were competing against Squarespace and Wix in the marketplace. And we had, if anybody looks up the old GoDaddy ads, I mean, you guys can go to YouTube and look at that. They're quite what I would say misogynistic, some of the very old ads, and we had to make a change 100%. So it wasn't just me, it was a huge team of people when we were doing this. And what we did is we focused on the client. And so this is the direct answer to your question. Not only who our client is today, but who is your going to be your client 5 years from now? And when we started to do that, we had some great usability researchers. So a shout out to them if they're listening. But they found that 60% of the future client base was going to be female-led businesses that we were selling to. And GoDaddy was putting out extremely misogynistic advertising. So change the game 2 rebrands later. And you guys can just look up GoDaddy now. The brand, you know, not only resonates more with the female audience, but it talks about, and of course, they're selling websites to small businesses. So it talks about small business owners being the hero. And by using the client as the focus, you can overcome a lot of these challenges of fighting for budget. Because if you walk into your leadership team and you say, hey, number one, maybe we're targeting the wrong person. We need to target, you know, the right ICP. And number two, this is really what resonates to them. And you can show that. Show it through anecdotal videos. Get on a, you know, a Zoom call, a Google Hangouts call with one of your clients. Nothing beats the client's voice. And so if you show your CEO or your leadership team the client's voice and they're listening, that's the perfect time that you capture, you know, the right information and then ask for your budget to execute against that.
So, but this means it's more like a qualitative approach, Anjali. Yeah? So I'm asking my clients, I of course can try to interpret the reactions of my clients with like kind of branded content. If I'm really going into a strong ROI discussion, I'm challenging this if this is enough, yeah? Because if I have a numbers-driven CEO or maybe my CFO is like, it's nice to have. And of course, we should adapt messaging to our client base. And we should also, of course, maybe have an appealing approach to them. But at the end, I also would like to know how much more do I sell? So is there an approach or a way to really understand the effects a strong brand has versus a, let's say, weak one on the
sure.
market?
The reason I gave the what I would call qualitative approach first is because you would be shocked, and I know that you talk to many founders, you know, across the region, but you would be shocked to know how many people throw money and spend money at the wrong ICP and the wrong messaging. And the reason they do that is because they do not do the qualitative research first.
Yes,
this
agreed.
And this is why I say this in my answer, because the qualitative research can spare you a lot of money and help to prove your ROI. So, you know, at the beginning of our discussion today, we talked about this chart of death and this roller coaster going up and down. And that's the first wave of the roller coaster, right? They throw a bunch of money. They want to create the equation. You know, they want to create, you know, their customer acquisition costs. They want their LTV. They want all these numbers. But is it actually at the right ICP? So that is, and is it the right messaging? This is why this qualitative is so important at the beginning. Now, let's assume you have that down. You've got the qualitative down. What do you do for the next steps? It's the test and the iterate. and constantly testing and iterating. There's a couple things you can do to measure brand. So for all of you, if for your listeners, if any of you out there have a brand that has awareness in the market, you can do brand awareness testing. You can do brand funnel testing. And there's a couple of great companies out there. There's Brand Watch, there's Ask a Test. You can, you know, go up market, and there's bigger companies that will do this. They will measure your brand efficacy. And this is just brand awareness and brand efficacy. If you want to measure how great your campaigns are doing, there's tons of tools out there where you can do A/B testing, MVT testing. You can measure campaigns. You can say, okay, I'm going to throw, you know, 1,000 euros at this one, 1,000 euros at that one. You can measure all kinds of things, you know, tagline messaging. You can get that down to a very nitty gritty science. But the reason I'm not spending a huge amount of time on that is because there's so many tools that do that for you. What early stage founders and operators are missing is they're missing the first step. It's like, you know, spending all your money and buying a really nice car to drive down the wrong road, and they're missing it completely. And only after they spent all that money, and then they're like, oh my gosh, it's completely the wrong thing. We have to stop. And you look all the money that you wasted if you just would have spent one quarter, two quarters, you know, doing this qualitative usability testing to get the right messaging down. Then you can do that iterative approach and then say, okay, I'm going to throw 1,000 euros at this. You know, what do I get back for it? Oh yeah, this is the right messaging. They really do resonate with it. Now I've got an equation. And then that's when it gets exciting. And then for all of those very data-driven CEOs or founders, that's when that gets exciting. What is not exciting is when you sit in a room with your leadership team, like, is this the right messaging? I don't know. You know, is this the right ICP? That's not an exciting conversation, because that means that, you know, you've missed a couple of steps along the way.
I'm a big fan of case studies, Angelia. So let's imagine I'm the founder of a cool new SaaS startup here in Berlin. It's doing ESG reporting or CSRD reporting, because there's a lot of regulation coming up. And I am very lucky to have you on my management top level C-level team as a co-founder or CMO, but I'm really a novice, like a beginner in brand. Yeah. So, and we are discussing now, you convinced me that there is a kind of importance to build a brand from the first day onwards. And I have, of course, a couple of questions now, how we are going to do this. So please take me on our brand building journey, like we built the ESG reporting tool. Let's call it Artista, as always.
Artista, very nice.
Artista, like, please take me to your hand or on your hand, and let's go and build the brand.
Sure, I feel like we're making a movie. It's like cut to scene. Here we go. So, okay, so Artista. What I usually start with brand is the what you believe statement. To me, this encompasses everything. If you, as a founder, operator, a salesperson, cannot simply say what you believe in 30 seconds, then it's game over. So Artista, what we believe, you know, we want to go towards a, you know, more sustainable economy, or we want to, you know, get rid of all carbon emissions by 2030 because we believe in whatever that is. So take your belief statement and then boil it down to who cares about that and why should they care? So you have a belief statement, and why should people care? And it's amazing to me how many founders and operators just can't get past those two steps. So what you believe, and this is very different. It's not what you sell. It's not the product you sell. It's not the price. It's not the product marketing and features. It's what you believe. And then why should people care?
So let's play this through. I like the approach. So probably what we are believing in, or me as a founder, is like, hey, every company could become carbon neutral until 2050. And to reach this, we need transparency in carbon emission reporting. Plus, of course, there is a regulation coming that we need to do this. But like, to keep it simple, I believe that transparency in numbers is the basis to become carbon neutral. And who cares about this? Probably more and more the CEOs of companies, because as said, they have pressure on reporting side. But I guess also like people working in sustainability departments or in ESG departments or corporate social responsibility managers. I think these are the people who probably care a lot about this, but to a wider extent, I can imagine also like almost or a high share of employees probably also care about this to answer your question. So there's a lot of potential personas in this case who could be the recipients of messages, but yeah, I hope you can work with my answer here.
So, okay. So, but what's the broader piece on why the world should care about this? So the ICP, that's great, but this is a really cool topic. So ESG, sustainability, why should the world care? Like, because there's so many, you know, there's so many companies out there that do this. It should be an easy statement so we could have, you know, a better future so that our planet can exist past the, you know, 2050, whatever that might be. I think that just needs to be tied in just a little bit. But outside of that, that's fine. And then, of course, your ICP. So if you're selling to sustainability managers or you're selling to C-levels or boards, why should they care? They want their legacies, right, for their companies. Yeah. They want that. And also consumers nowadays are voting with their values. So this is why people want to care as well. So once you have your belief statement and why should people care, then you kind of go into what is your main tag. And this kind of goes towards your elevator or your lift pitch. And the reason I go towards this is you have to be able to articulate what you mean in 30 seconds or less. So Artista, sustainability, all of this, what would be... What are we selling? Maybe we should talk about that just a little bit. Are we selling...
We're selling a SaaS product which helps you to collect all the data and then prepare the reports we need to send to the government, let's say, make it like, you know, like this kind of stuff. But what we are selling in a more sexy way, so the tagline, not so easy probably to manage this out in 30 seconds here, but probably we're selling an ease of a process, because I guess there are a lot of people involved, a lot of data, and without a software, it becomes quite messy and paperwork and Excel sheets. So probably we sell something easy for a complex solution or task companies will have.
So like sustainability insights made easy, or like something, you know, something like this that you just get started. And so once you do that, branding, this is just the what we believe, why people care, and then you have a tagline. Then you start to get into your tone of voice. Like, what does that look like? This starts to go into the design area, the look and the feel. So this is kind of going a little bit deeper for, you know, the listeners. But there is a science behind colors. There is a science behind typography, and it's not fluff. It's not, you know, something that's just out there and doesn't mean anything and doesn't tie to the bottom line. And for all of those, any listeners right now that wants a great use case, look at Jaguar. Look at what they just did with their rebrand and their car. So I don't know if you saw, but they just basically came out with a new rebrand, a whole new typography typeface. Any of you that have driven Jaguar cars or have seen, you know, James Bond in the Jaguar movies, classic cars, sexy, sophisticated, amazing. They just came out with this ad that is like bright bubble pink with a and I'm not making this up, bright bubble pink with like people that look like they're, you know, I don't know, from a different planet, completely, you know, modern looking, I don't know, type of individuals. So look that up on YouTube. And then they just unveiled a sneak peek of what their new cars will be. And they look like something out of a futuristic like sci-fi movie. And one has to wonder, why are they doing this, right? That was my first question. They have such a great heritage brand. Why are they doing this? So what we were learning, I was talking on a different podcast about this, is they have stopped producing what I call, you know, gasoline or petrol made vehicles. And they're only now producing electric vehicles. And so just like in the use case that I talked about, you know, with GoDaddy, they're looking at who will their future clients be? What is the future of the industry going towards? And of course, electric, right? And they're looking at the new cohort of clients, because the old cohort of clients, you know, who knows?
Maybe
they're not going to be around. It's the past.
Yeah.
What's going to be in the future? And so this has created so much buzz. So if any of you are looking at a case in branding and why, the jury's still out if it's a good rebrand or not, but it certainly has created a huge amount of buzz and discussion around Jaguar, where we can actually say 2 weeks ago, nobody was talking about it. Now, if you look all over social, all over YouTube, it's everywhere. So bravo to the team for creating some buzz, and you know, it will be interesting. But anyway, going back to the science of colors, colors have a science behind them. And that science, whether you are a man or a woman looking at the screen, it projects something to you. Another great example of this is Headspace. There is a little battle going on between Headspace and Calm as far as meditation apps go. When you think about being relaxed, do you think about looking at a screen full of bright orange?
Probably not, no.
Exactly. So it was a very interesting choice by Headspace. I'm a Calm fan myself, so I use that app. And they have the way that they did their brand with, you know, the different colors of blue, you know, the way that they put together the app, you know, the ease of looking at it on the screen, all of this has to go into branding. So the reason I'm bringing this up is because also early stage founders and operators tend to forget about this. And they tend to forget that all of this comes together to create your brand look and feel. And, you know, to all the fabulous designers and creatives out there, it really is the blend of art and science coming together.
Short break here for our partner, Molly. Accepting payments online can still be difficult, but it shouldn't be, and it doesn't have to be. Do you want to grow your SaaS company, but handling payments is still painful? Molly makes payment simple and scalable. Molly's flexible solution integrates seamlessly into your platform, opens up new revenue opportunities, and takes the hassle out of the onboarding and processing. Here's an example. Stardeck, a SaaS platform for the hospitality industry, used Molly to efficiently manage international payments and enter new markets. The result? Less complexity and overhead, more revenue, and faster growth. Let Molly be your partner for smarter growth. You can find more information at www.molly.com/artist. Molly, more turnover, less effort. Back to the podcast. I mean, me as an early stage founder, Anjali, I am very limited in resources and I'm also not skilled in this kind of thing. So what would be your recommendation how to approach this kind of problem? Because I see the value and I see the importance, because also something which you like just put in the ground for a very long time and it becomes more and more difficult to change it later on. So what would be your recommendation how to make this decision about a font, about a color, about... if you're not really experienced and skilled.
So what I like to do, again, I'm a really big fan of what I call the old school usability studies, because you get the anecdotal why. And people can give you data, but because right now I think we're in an era of what I call data paralysis, because there's so many tools and data points out there and people have no idea, you know, what those data points mean or the impact of it anymore. So nothing beats getting people into a physical or a virtual room and just saying, okay, so if you're the brand Artista, and let's say, what do you want to be associated with? Being, you know, very progressive, being informative, you know, being, you know, the knowledge source of the future, maybe fun, exciting, whatever it is you want to be associated with. Then you start to put out some different, you know, colors, some different designs. And then you start to ask just, you know, a very small group of people, does this reflect? Ask them, okay, what does this sound like or what does this look like to you? And you get that information from them. Mm-hmm. Is it progressive? Is it informative? And I would say 8 to 9 times out of 10, when I've seen these studies done, it is actually the complete opposite of what these companies are trying to convey. So, and this is why I say, I know you asked about, you know, the data-driven approach, which is super important. But so many early stage founders and operators forget this first step and they just go down the road with the data. And then they're like, oops, the data isn't matching, you know, the outcomes that we're trying to get. And like, okay, well, did you actually start with step one? And a lot of them didn't. And this is something for all the early stage founders and operators out there. This is easy to do. All the early stage founders I know, what do they do when they're trying to sell their product or service? They go to their network, right? So if you have the network, go to your network and say, hey, this is what we believe. Does that make sense? This is why we believe it. Does that make sense? Would you buy into that? And here are the first concepts of what it's going to look like visually. Mm-hmm. What does this mean to you? Like, what's the feeling that you get? Because brand is really also about a feeling. What's the feeling that you're getting? So if as Artista, since that's our you know, case study example, is it fun? Is it exciting? Is it progressive? Is it informative? If those are the kinds of things. And your network ICP, you know, cohort, they're saying, well, gosh, you know, it doesn't seem really informative, or I don't really understand what I'm looking at. Or then you know maybe you need to try something else. And, you know, these kinds of things don't cost much. You can even get your network together for, you know, a coffee video chat session or a dinner or a lunch. Very easy to get this information. So I would just encourage founders and operators to not skip this very, very crucial step.
So it goes along a little bit with the first thing, you know, if you try to define your ICP, you need to do user research, you need to talk to people, you need to position your value, and you say like, okay, if you really want to build a brand, it's the next thing you should do with kind of user cohorts or potential ICPs, like you call the network ICPs, because they give you a very direct and quick and fast and also like cheap answer. I think every founder should build up a kind of a consulting cohort or like pilot customers who can help you, especially with those things. It's not super costly. You don't need to book agencies. You don't need to hire super expensive professionals. I like the approach, Anjali. I really like the approach. And I think, yeah, if you do the effort and go for like a kind of a little bit representative number, so more than three, yeah, and you try to find patterns, then this is super helpful. What I see a lot is like, okay, people do two, three conversations, maybe also biased with very good friends or other people, and then they get the answers they like to hear and not the answers which the client base usually gives. But okay, I think I got a basic understanding how to set up my brand and what's like your approach of building it. Let's assume we have done this now for Artista, and you mentioned a couple of cool things with Jagra already. What are the things you think in 2025 will happen from cool brands? What are maybe initiatives, new things coming up brands will do to create awareness, to be innovative? Yeah, so any kind of trends you are seeing, any things we should take care of?
Yes, and I what I always tell people for 2025 and what I see changing the market now is storytelling is becoming king. So mm-hmm. It used to be content, and content can be all kinds of things, right? Now it's storytelling. The why.
Because there's a saturation probably of content like almost everywhere.
There's a huge saturation. There's also a saturation of ads. I mean, yeah. Especially depending on who your ICP is and who you're selling to. I mean, myself as a C-level, I get bombarded on LinkedIn by so many, you know, ads a day. I also get SDRs. So good job to the SDRs for reaching out. But, you know, you get so, you just get petitioned all the time. But what people do love is great stories and storytelling. And it kind of goes to that human aspect. Everybody wants to hear a great story, and especially if it's one that you connect with, or it's something that can be polarizing, hopefully not in a bad way, but polarizing in a way where you can spark a discussion. People will remember that. So on a speech I did, I think it was at SaaStock last year, I talked about this study that LinkedIn did with Ipsos. Super, mm-hmm. super cool study where they basically surveyed marketing leaders across all continents across the globe. And they said, okay, you know, upcoming for the next year, what are you going to be spending your budgets on? And of course, as you know, what you prioritize your budget, of course, is what you hold value on. And you came in first was lead generation. That makes sense. They want to fill the pipeline. They want it to be associated with revenue. But especially for enterprise selling, you would think ABM would be up there. You think that these big content plays would be up there. And you want to know what came in number second? Brand. Brand came in second. ABM came in fourth. Fourth. And so this is just to tell, because I know right now there's a huge push for ABM, and there's no problem with ABM, especially if you have enterprise. And I mean, it works. It's fine. It's great. But because early stage founders and operators are missing the branding piece, you're finding that more marketing and go-to-market leaders are now starting to say, hey, we actually have to put our brand name out there so that all the rest of our efforts can work. Whether it's marketing or whether it's sales efforts, it's an entire machine. It's a comprehensive 360-degree system that has to work. It's like if you're sitting on a chair and the chair has, you know, four, you know, spokes coming down and three of the spokes are not there, you're not going to sit in the chair very well. So it's the same kind of thing. And I think B2B, you know, SaaS leaders are starting to recognize that, and they're starting to prioritize that. But for all of you out there, I can find the study. We can drop it in the comments so people can see it, because I mean, LinkedIn and Ipsos, a really great partnership that they did. And it's a great survey of, you know, where people are putting their money.
We will definitely put this to the show notes, Anjali. So feel free to send us any resources you think could be helpful for our founders to become more brand aware, like brand experts. You mentioned storytelling, which is like super interesting for me. If I think about storytelling so far, it's usually two things we do in SaaS. It's like customer voices on the website, yeah, and maybe webinars with happy customers who tell how great it is. It's the first steps. Also, these instruments, I think, become less valuable, more saturated. So if you think about storytelling in B2B SaaS, what could this be? Could this be like videos from customers, how my software changed their daily doing? Or like what could be innovative formats people maybe should think about starting thinking about from today onwards?
Yeah, so the first part, what you mentioned really was customer testimonials and product marketing, which has kind of been the stalwarts, right, of B2B SaaS. And I think it's a little bit overplayed. You still need to do it, but should you go out with it at the beginning? I question that. The storytelling piece comes down to who, again, is your ICP? What do they care about? And what are their pains? So depending upon what it is you're selling, pick your ICP and pretend that you're them for a day. So a great example of this, when I worked at Intuit, we, you know, did B2B accounting software. And I mean, let's face it, accounting software, not sexy.
Super exciting.
Right? Very, very exciting. And so we had a, gosh, what was it? It was a partnership, I think, with American Express. It was something called Receipt Match, or basically, I mean, nowadays it's very common, but you basically, you know, take a picture of your receipt and it will upload. And, you know, that's great, right? But I don't know how life-changing or how it's going to, you know, solve the world's problems. But what we did is we, you know, the team made a really cool video out of it and they made it really funny. And so people okay. could relate to it. So I think I have to go back to the video, but it was like, you know, take all your receipts with it and match this with it. And it was very, very cute. And so people were laughing at the situation. And I think, you know, the storytelling doesn't always have to be this sob story. It doesn't always have to be super heartfelt. It can be funny too. So especially in a market or an industry that's not sexy, people know it's not sexy. So let's make fun of it and let's get people interested in it. That's what I would say. But the point of the storytelling and why I think 2025, I'm bullish, very bullish that storytelling is going to be the name of the game, because especially if you are a B2B SaaS operator or founder and you're in a saturated market and you're selling services and you're competing against, you know, 3 to 4 incumbents, you know, I'm just not sold that the traditional product marketing is going to work for you. And then let's be honest, I mean, product marketing is really a mid-funnel, you know, type of
educational,
you know, thing. You really need this top of funnel piece. And this is where I think B2B SaaS is really missing a key opportunity, is the top of funnel. A lot of times they focus on mid-funnel and bottom of funnel, you know, activities, which is fine. And you need that. But you're not going to get there. It's a funnel. You're not going to get there if you don't have, you know, the top of funnel things happening.
And what is the priority format you're thinking about? Is it video, Anjali? And if it is video, what are the platforms you play it out? Is it more the business platform, like you said, LinkedIn? Or because you want to reach the user persona, is it the traditional social media platforms like Instagram or even TikTok you play out the B2B SaaS content then?
This is where I say it depends. It really depends on who you're selling to, right? So even though I do have my personal favorite platforms, I don't say that it's not a playbook. It's not something that you just say.
One fits all doesn't exist, huh?
No. You really figure out who your ICP is, which is, of course, using the branding exercise that we just talked about is a great way, you know, to do that and what they care about, and then find out where they are. So if they're on TikTok, go there. And there's tons of cool companies, like, and you look at HubSpot and others that are B2B SaaS companies that are starting to go onto TikTok. So if your clients are there, go there. If they're in old-fashioned magazines, go there. If they're in, you know, social meetup groups, go there. It just, the whole idea is to find where your ICP and your clients live, so to speak, and, you know, kind of where they live and play, and to make sure that you're dominating those channels. So it's kind of a cool exercise, because you think of yourself as an investigator and you're trying to really figure out, okay, well, where are my clients live? You know, what are they interested in? And this is why, again, the usability piece is so important at the beginning.
Thanks a lot for this super insightful answers here. I'd like to take the last minutes, Anjali, to maybe do a small excursus, because I know it's also one of your passion topics. And it's also a topic which is super important for us. You know, we perceive that marketing is one of the very few functionalities where we see, fortunately, more female leaders than in other SaaS functions. And it's a thing we are thinking about a lot here in Artist, and you are happily helping us. What can we do for the ecosystem here to really empower more female leaders in all kind of positions, in sales and the finance functions? Because, you mean, you know the numbers, yeah? It's like 12-13%, I think, based on last year. So any ideas, and I know you have a lot of ideas, you would like to share, what can we do?
So first of all, believe that you can find these female leaders, because what I hear from a lot of founders is, oh, they don't exist, I can't find them. Yes, you can. You just need to look for them. We do exist. Absolutely. We are here and we know each other, and just start asking. There are female leaders in engineering, in product, in, you know, anything that is technical, finance. They're everywhere. So that is step one. Don't go with this myth that they don't exist. They do. We're here. The second thing is go above and beyond to find them and to hire them. And I would also say, try to make sure in your hiring processes that you can have enough female representation. So for example, and don't try to just pick out the token, you know, female in your company. But what I'm saying is, try to make sure that you hire enough females in your company, so there's enough female representation, meaning that more females will want to join. So for
example,
effort,
like exactly, just do a special effort for this and don't go the easy way.
Exactly. The second thing is, it's not just about hiring women into, whether it's leadership roles or any roles, it's about retaining them. So making sure that you have an atmosphere within your company where women feel like they're able to speak up and they're able to have a voice. So it's not always about being the loudest person in the room, making sure everybody gets a chance to speak. Like, just, you know, simple things like this can go a long way. Making sure that women in the company have enough mentorship, that, you know, you're supporting. And also, if you're a male founder or, you know, go-to-market leader, being very vocal about your support of female leadership and women in different roles. And there's been some great, you know, male leaders out there that have done this. And, you know, we call them the male allies, and they've been absolutely phenomenal. But the more you speak it, the more you back up your words with action, and the more that you are determined to make sure that you can have females in the candidate pool and females within leadership roles and any roles, frankly, within your company, you'll find it's a snowball effect in the right way. And it will just naturally gravitate. So those are the best examples that I can give. And, you know, we're all here and we're ready to support.
And you're actually doing this quite a lot, Anjali. So I'm very thankful for this. And as we agreed, or as we wanted to do the effort, as you said, we are trying to go for at least 40% female speakers on the next Artist Summit. And as you said, if you do the effort, there are super great founders and C-level executives all everywhere in Europe. With great background, with great expertise. So I'm quite confident that we will manage. There's a lot more to do. Yeah, as you said, it's just, I think, the beginning. But if you have any ideas, if you're listening, if you want to support us, feel free to reach out to Anjali or to me. Would be our big pleasure hearing your ideas and also maybe your challenges, the challenges you're facing. From my point of view, thanks a lot for this great and insightful conversation, Anjali. It was my big pleasure having you here in the show. I wish you a great afternoon, a great evening, a great Christmas time. But before I let you go and enjoying this great gray Berlin weather again, it would be my pleasure to hear if you have a recommendation for us to eat in Berlin, especially with a non-Berlin background. So what was a kind of a place which impressed you a lot where you like to go on a regular basis?
Okay, so I actually have two recommendations. I think
you can only give one. It's a basic rule.
No.
You need the next one for the next episode.
Okay,
because we only allow one. I'm very sorry here.
Okay, only one. Okay, in that case, because I'm from California, there is a really great place that has this kind of Asian California kind of hybrid mixed cuisine. It's in Charlottenburg. It's called Grace. So right, it's inside of Hotel Zoo. So the Apple Store on Kudamm Street in Charlottenburg, it's either right next door or two doors down. There's a hotel called Hotel Zoo, very fancy, very bougie. And you go all the way in the back and there is a restaurant called Grace. It is phenomenal. And they have this Asian fusion, hype California, you know, kind of cuisine. So I know that there's a lot of different food here in Berlin, but this is absolutely one of my favorites. And it's not just the food, it's the ambiance. It's just beautiful and immaculate. So I highly recommend it. And no, I'm not a paid sponsor for the restaurant, but I highly recommend.
No one is here. So if you like to discuss your brand strategy with Angelique, go there, try to meet her, try to spot her there. Otherwise, I think LinkedIn is also a good medium to reach you. Angelique, thank you very much. It was a big pleasure and hope to have you back soon. Wish you a great Christmas time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you everyone for listening to today's episode. As the year draws to a close, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to you, our incredible community of SaaS founders, investors, and innovators. This holiday season, we celebrate not just the milestone reached or the deals closed, but the resilience, especially this year, creativity, and passion that each of you brings to shaping the future of SaaS and the Artist Network. 2024 has been a challenging but inspiring year of learning, growth, and of course, many new connections. Thanks to you. Every episode, every shared insight, and every story we've explored together wouldn't have been possible without your support and engagement. Thanks a lot. Here's to 2025, filled with bold ideas, new opportunities, continued success, and of course, a gorgeous and inspiring Artist Summit 2025. Thank you for being part of our journey, and we look forward to many more inspiring conversations in the year ahead, starting in January after our Christmas break. Wishing you and your loved ones a Merry Christmas and a prosperous New Year. We are back in Jan. Warm regards, Julius, Janice, and Matthias. Bye-bye.